With the 27th pick in the 2016 NBA Draft, the Toronto Raptors select Pascal Siakam from Douala, Cameroon.
Siakam. How great is that? What an athletic play, and it energizes the crowd.
And I need you. And I miss you.
Et bien, sur la mise, comment je vais sur le parti?
It didn't happen one time.
No, he didn't forget his bag one time, bro.
Hands lead up top, Pascal. Siakam with the bucket, Canada. The NBA title is yours.
He is your NBA All-Star representing Cameroon.
Thank you to Canada as a country. Thank you to Toronto as a city. And that's always be the story. Like, it will always be Toronto's home.
Represent, talk to me. Talk to me. Open gym.
2 seconds to the rim. And the buzzer. Spicy P comes through.
Fans, let's welcome back Spicy P. Pascal
Welcome to another edition of Smith and Jones. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. And that was just a little taste, of course, of what happened on Wednesday night when the Toronto Raptors welcomed Pascal Siakam back to town as a member of the Indiana Pacers. It was certainly an emotional night for Siakam and for so many in the fan base. Section 119, Jonesy right behind us where we were broadcasting the game. Everybody decked out in the number 43 Siakam jerseys. Pascal referenced it in his post-game comments how he said, you know, when I first got to Toronto, I didn't even see a 43 jersey in the store. And then all these years later, I've got an entire section of people wearing 43. I remember back to when he was named to the All-Star team for the first time, and he was at the NBA store in New York City. And I asked him, we were both there talking to him about, you know, little kids walking around with Siakam across their backs, people from all different walks of life, all different colors and creeds and whatnot, wearing the Siakam name, and how proud his dad must be looking down on him and seeing the Siakam surname globally across so many, you know, the backs of so many, you know, men, women, and children and whatnot. And it was obviously a very, very special night for Pascal, and even more special that the Pacers got the W.
Yeah, it was, I mean, Eric, we've been around long enough to have witnessed these moments, and it's amazing with the Raptors still a relatively young franchise when you think about, you know, teams like the Pistons and the Celtics and the Lakers, that we run into people we're connected to from Toronto all over the league, and they speak fondly of Toronto. But, you know, I got to believe Pascal is probably up there in the top five or top 10 when you think about people that came to Toronto, grinded their way to success in Toronto, were beloved by the fans in Toronto, and then, you know, left in a way that people just hated to see him go and just welcomed him back. Like think about some of those names. I mean, it wasn't Vince initially. It wasn't Chris Bosh initially. Like, you think about guys like Mo Pete. You know, you think about Fred. You know, the fan base softened for a Kyle because, you know, he had the championship there. So, you know, it was a pretty special night to see a guy that made his name here and then left on really good terms, because it seemed like he didn't even want to leave, and came back and got that. It was really, really special.
Well, let's look at things maybe from an Indiana perspective as well, looking back to the trade, not just Wednesday's game, and looking ahead to the future and a whole lot more as well, as we bring into the conversation Indiana Pacers host of the pre-half and post sideline reporter. You hear him sometimes doing play-by-play broadcast on both TV and radio. He's the voice of the WNBA's Indiana Fever. I mean, he's all over the place, TV and radio in Indianapolis, Pat Boylan. So, Pat, Wednesday night in Toronto was certainly an emotional night for a lot of people involved, and obviously with Pascal at the top of the list. But putting aside the end result itself, a big win for the Pacers, no doubt, a fun game, back and forth a good chunk of the evening. But if we kind of take a big picture look at essentially the last month or so, how can you, or can you yet, assess Siakam's impact on this team? and what it could mean for, you know, the final 25, 30 games of the season, let alone, you know, I would imagine you and so many Pacers fans hoping a longer run in the postseason and then a longer run with Pascal in potentially seasons to come.
Sure, and I appreciate you guys having me. You both do great work, so it's an honor to be joined by both of you. And I think you can absolutely get a sense for his impact so far about a month in. But what I think you can't yet totally get a sense for is just what he and Halliburton together can potentially do. Now, we have gotten to see those two together now for more than a handful of games. But Halliburton maybe had his best game since he's come back against Toronto. But in general, he's kind of looked 80, 90% good, but not quite the player that is going to be starting the All-Star game and the type of player that we've seen for a good chunk of the year before he went down in early January. And I thought Siakam was massive to the Pacers kind of being able to bridge that gap without Halliburton. That obviously wasn't initially the plan, but the Pacers had a pretty darn good month of January with some really tough competition. And in large part, without Halliburton, and in large part due to how well Siakam played, he had a triple-double in one of his first few games. And this was something, if you go back to the Pacers last year, they got off to a pretty good start to the season, but then Halliburton went down for a few weeks and the Pacers disintegrated. And the difference here so far this year is that when Halliburton went down for a few weeks, the Pacers were able to keep the boat afloat, and Siakam had a large part to do with that. So I think the most interesting thing from the Pacers' perspective becomes, out of the All-Star break, assuming Halliburton is, you know, back to 100%, how those two look together in what's a really tightly contested conference, and what those two can potentially accomplish together.
Hey, Pat, I get the feeling from the first half, notwithstanding, on Wednesday night when Pascal was shedding tears over, I mean, his Players Tribune post was the perfect jumping off point for the tribute that he got in Toronto, and you could see the tears in his eyes. And like I said, Quinn Buckner said to us, that would affect me, you know, so I'm not surprised he only scored like 2 points, but he came out scoring 7 of the first 12 in the second half, and it looks to me like he's the guy, the kind of guy that the Pacers have never had, where you can give him the ball, and this is what you probably need in the playoffs, and say, hey, man, go get us a bucket. Or if they double team you and you're used to that, get somebody else an easy shot, because they'll scout you in the playoffs. And like, I just think that's something that the Pacers could be missing. He seems to fill that role really well.
I completely agree. And, you know, Halliburton's been great, but they've needed kind of a co-star along with him. I think what they've been able to do over the last year plus before the Siakam trade, for the most part, was admirable. But as you know, when you get late in games and against good teams, and if the playoffs come into the picture, stars are what win games in those situations, and stars are what win playoff series. And Siakam's been to the literal top with you guys not all that long ago, and I think, A, that experience is very valuable. But I think, too, having a guy that you can just say, hey, look, if you're going to put two bodies on Tyrese Halliburton, we've got somebody else to throw the ball his direction. That wasn't exactly what happened late in the game in Toronto, but you could make the case that the biggest shot of the night from the Pacers' perspective did come from Siakam in a late-game situation. And so when I look at, you know, what the Pacers are capable of from a where-is-their-ceiling perspective, I think that's where he kind of hopefully elevates things the most. Halliburton is emerging into this big-time star, but you still need – we've seen this from numerous teams around the NBA – you still need another bona fide guy, at least one, next to a player like that to really start to talk about yourself in a serious contender position. Now, we don't know if the Pacers are there yet. They just haven't had enough time together with Halliburton coming off that injury, and whether there's enough from a supporting cast to truly be a contender. And that might not be a conversation this year, but I think that's exactly what the Siakam trade does for the Pacers, is it elevates their ceiling because Halliburton has somebody with him now where if they want to try to take Halliburton out of the game, that's fine. You know, Siakam can go get you a bucket in a way that the Pacers didn't previously have on this roster. And the type of scorer, I mean, you go back to previous Pacers years, Oladipo had a great couple year stretch. Sabonis was very good. Paul George before that. But you're talking about a limited number of guys that the Pacers have had that truly, you know, have that skill in their arsenal.
Pat, you led me perfectly to where I wanted to go with this, and it's always easier, clearly, you know, looking back on things, whether it be a week, a month, a year, 5 years later, and being that Monday morning quarterback, with no disrespect intended at all to Sabonis, who is a hell of a player and still having a hell of a career and putting up great numbers and having a great impact in Sacramento. If you look now at how the dust has settled, in a very short period of time, being able to turn Sabonis into Halliburton, Halliburton turning into the type of player that, well, Jonesy, I'll let you tell the story in a second, that both Paul and I were kind of led to believe might be arguably the best or among the best one or two players in the draft, and he's certainly looking every bit the part right now. And then you're able to parlay shrewd moves into, well, we got a pretty damn good replacement in Sabonis with Pascal Siakam, and on top of that, we've drafted well. It has really kind of fast-tracked the rebuild, the retweak, the sort of rejig of the Pacers on the fly and turn them into a pretty serious team in very, very limited amount of time, a short period of time.
Yeah, if you look at where the Pacers were just a little over 2 years ago, just before that trade deadline 2 years ago, they remind me, frankly, a lot of where Chicago is now, in that they had a couple of all-stars and they had Caris LeVert and Miles Turner and Domantas Sabonis and Malcolm Brogdon. And like, there were a lot of really good players there and a couple all-stars, but at the end of the day, it never really fit together at the level that you were hoping for. And I think there was significant concern that all those guys in the moment were, you know, kind of in their prime. So it's not like you say, okay, well, let's continue to roll this out and see if it can fit. And the Pacers pivoted pretty dramatically. That Sabonis-Halliburton trade is always going to be a fascinating one to me, because it immediately turned Sacramento into a playoff team, and it immediately ended that drought. And Sabonis is excellent, but what Halliburton has become since that trade is, you know, the type of transformative player that the Pacers, frankly, you know, if you look back in their history, like even the best Pacers teams, maybe haven't had a player that has the ability to get to the level that Halliburton does. I'm not saying he's there yet, but the difference there is the ceiling of a Halliburton, I think, and the ceiling of a Sabonis, and these guys are both all-stars, but Halliburton's 23. He's putting up assist numbers, if he can finish the season like this, that haven't been seen since John Stockton. He's scoring at an incredibly efficient rate, and he's not far off of 50-40-90. And he's really embraced just kind of taking over this team, and he'll be the de facto host here to All-Star Weekend in Indianapolis. It was the absolute best-case scenario, and sometimes it's hard to imagine. Like, things were looking fairly bleak here just over 2 years ago, and they've got a long way to go. Don't get me wrong, to being where they feel like they can, but you just don't typically see when teams decide to kind of restart in the way that the Pacers did. You don't see things flip as quickly and as dramatically as the Pacers have so far, as quickly as they have. And it'll be fascinating to see if they can kind of keep this positive momentum rolling. Obviously, there's a hope that Pascal Siakam is the next piece in that.
Yeah. And you know, Pat, I look at the way, you know, the Pacers play, and Eric and I had Seth Greenberg on our show, on this very show, before the draft. And, you know, there was Anthony Edwards was kind of number one, but there were a lot of questions. And Seth Greenberg unabashedly said to us, "I'd take Tyrese Halliburton number one." And we both looked at each other and went, "Oh, okay." And here's a guy that follows it pretty closely. And I you know, hey, if you did that draft over again, I wonder how many people might take him number one. I mean, Edwards would still be consensus, but boy, you know, Tyrese would be right there. And when I look at the pieces, and, you know, you just talked about the way he's playing, Pascal's another piece. What do you think the next piece is? And can they find a piece that will play that style? I said to Rick Carlisle on Wednesday night, walking out of the tunnel at about, you know, 6:20 after he did his news conference, I tip my hat to you, Rick, because you've adjusted your coaching style to the way it is. And sometimes old dogs don't learn the new tricks, but what's the next piece for them, Pat, that can play that way?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And to go back to your topic on Rick Carlisle, he actually has told a story about how he, of course, was in Dallas during the draft of Halliburton, and how they were desperately trying to move up in the draft to get him, and they just couldn't get it done. I don't know that he necessarily saw him as the number one player in the draft, but it's interesting going back and hearing some of the stories from him. And you're right. I mean, if you look at, you know, Rick Carlisle was here in Indiana in the early 2000s, and the way that he has just kind of shifted his general coaching style, I think it's why he's been as successful as he has for as long as he has. But to answer your question, you know, before the Siakam trade, I think it was glaringly obvious that the Pacers kind of needed a two-way wing that could score, that could defend, and just be kind of a dynamic player for them to go along with Haliburton. And I think Siakam has filled a lot of those needs, but I still think if you could, you know, pie in the sky, pick another type of player, it still probably is something like a three that is a dynamic offensive player, but also a shutdown defensive player. And when you look at where the Pacers are and where they hope they can go, a big deciding factor on if they're going to get there is going to be defensively, because the Pacers have been number one offensively in the NBA for nearly the entirety of the season. And frankly, you know, much of that was before Siakam got here. But can they become the type of defensive team that's necessary to win in the playoffs when the game slows down, when the, you know, in the fourth quarter, when the big stars are the only ones touching the ball down the stretch in games? And so I still think that's the question that has to be answered from the Pacers' perspective. I think Siakam answers a lot of those questions. I mean, his versatility is something the Pacers sorely needed. You guys know this even better than I do, but the guy can play five if necessary. He can play three if necessary. He's probably a natural four for where the game is right now. But they can move him into a lot of different spots. And I think still finding, you know, more versatility and more defense on the wing is probably the next goal. And, you know, what that looks like or where that comes, I mean, there's hope that it could be internally, I think, with Benedict Mathurin, who unfortunately didn't play in the game on Wednesday, but is the sixth overall pick from just a couple of years ago. So there are maybe numerous different avenues that that could happen. I still think at the end of the day, you're looking to acquire talent, whether that's growing it within what you have or whether that's finding it via trade or free agency, or at this point, probably not in the draft, but you never know. And I think it's just acquiring that high-level talent and trying to put top-level players next to Haliburton. And I think the enticing thing that the franchise is hoping for is who would not want to play with this point guard who's averaging almost 13 assists per game, and everybody that comes into his orbit all of a sudden is having a career year. Miles Turner last year, a great example of that. So I think they hope that that's a really good recruiting pitch, and I don't know if that was a part in – Siakam's, you know, desire. We heard him say right after the trade that he had a desire to be here long term, and he hopes that's the case. But it's potentially a great recruiting tool that a player in a city like Indianapolis and a team like the Pacers that doesn't necessarily get the big free agents all that often, it's a tool that I don't know that this franchise has ever had, and it'll be interesting to see if they can leverage that here over the next few years.
So, Pat, I'm going to give you like a word salad here of a really long question, and it's the way my brain's firing right now. I love what the Pacers have done. To me, they're an example that the Raptors could try to use right now, or at least could at least hope to be. Can they, with shrewd and proper drafting and shrewd and proper trading, put themselves in a position to be back in? And when I say contender, I don't necessarily mean championship contender, but playoff contender, legit playoff team, and building towards being a championship contender in a year or two like the Pacers have done. We'll see how it works for Toronto. But the one thing I love with the Pacers is that they – okay, Mathurin and Nembhard, and we thought Turner was getting traded forever. He's still there. And you've got Haliburton. Now you've got Siakam. But at the same time, in order to keep Siakam, it's going to cost – pretty much, in all likelihood, $250 million. And then you've got these young dudes that you hope are going to be part of it moving forward, but it's going to cost to keep them. So trying to figure out who fits, how they fit, how much it's going to cost, and then who might need to be used as a chip to dangle to trade in order to acquire what might take you over the top or what you can't afford because you can't afford to keep everyone. I mean, you don't get paid to make those decisions, nor do I. But the Pacers have the luxury, I suppose, of having some very difficult decisions in spite of the fact that it all looks positive. This is going to be hard to navigate going forward.
Oh, it certainly is, and it's a good problem that every team hopes to have, and frankly, sure, it's one that the Pacers haven't really had in a long time. I mean, you know, the Pacers had a nice couple year, two, three-year run there with Oladipo and with Sabonis and that group, but neither of those guys, Oladipo or Sabonis, were on the type of max deals that Halliburton will be going into next year. Assuming Siakam stays, we'll be getting a pretty penny next year, and so really, it's not a position that the franchise has been in quite some time. I mean, you even go back to the early 2010s with the Paul George, David West, Roy Hibbert teams. I mean, those teams were pushing up against the cap. But even then, it wasn't like the Pacers are trying to acquire this guy, but there's maybe not enough room for him. And how do they make that work? So that's, you know, the next kind of fascinating step into all of this is assuming that they can continue to keep it rolling is how all that looks, and you said it correctly. It's over my head, and the cap and all of how all that works at the intricate levels, at least as it does, is certainly over my head. But yeah, good problem to have, and I think it'll be interesting to see how they navigate it. But it's something that I think they've been preparing for a couple of years, and a great example of that is the Miles Turner deal. So they were able to work out a deal with Miles Turner last season where they extended him. And last year, the Pacers weren't even at the cap floor at the time. So they had all this money to spend. And they just said, well, how about we give it all to Turner right now on a front-loaded deal? And Turner then, in subsequent years, will make less. He'll get more than his value probably right away. And then he's a little quote-unquote underpaid for the next few years. It all works out for him from a bottom-line standpoint over 4 years. But it saves you a little bit on the cap. And so the Pacers do have Turner on a friendly deal. And yeah, that always is kind of like the final step of a team building is, first of all, can you get the type of talent to potentially win? And then when you do, and then when these big contracts kick in, you know, Halliburton's still on his rookie deal. Siakam's not making crazy money. It's a question that they're going to have to answer that the front office hasn't answered in a very long time, and it'll be interesting to see how they navigate that tightrope.
Well, the other part of that, Pat, too, is, and I think Masai Ujiri had a great line when he said, and we know, not all free agents go to places like Toronto and Indiana and Milwaukee and Minnesota. Like, they rarely get the big splash free agents. But as Masai Ujiri said, you need to have enough flexibility and or assets so that when a star player decides he's unhappy somewhere in the middle of the season, suddenly that's free agency. And looking at Pacer management, they haven't had the problem for a while. But do you think they relish that problem and would say, hey, you know what? We'll bump up against the first apron if we got a chance to have a deep run into the playoffs?
Yeah, I absolutely think that they do, and I think it's something that they've kind of been mentally preparing for how to handle for quite some time. But you're right. You know, Indianapolis is a smaller market. Toronto is definitely a bigger city than Indianapolis, but being in Canada, I'm sure it sometimes deals with a lot of the same challenges in that when big-time free agents are coming around, it's a little bit of a tougher conversation to get them to come. So you have to be very good in drafting, and you have to be very good in, you know, the trade world. And I think that's something that if there's one thing that this Pacers franchise has done really well, dating back to the Paul George move, I mean, the crazy thing about Halliburton is the Pacers almost assuredly do not have him if the Paul George move isn't made. Because if you go back and you look at this thing in layers, Paul George is traded for Sabonis and Oladipo. And I actually do see some potential comparisons there in what the Raptors are doing, and that, you know, I think some people maybe expected Toronto to just blow the whole thing up and get a bunch of picks and maybe a 20-year-old and completely start over. And what it appears to me the Raptors are doing, and what certainly the Pacers did back then, was said, no, let's try to get a couple of guys who maybe were miscast because they had other players around them. Sabonis had Steven Adams next to him, and Oladipo had Russell Westbrook next to him, and said, we think that if we give these guys, maybe this is Quickly and Barrett, some opportunity that they haven't had in their previous team, that they can shine. And that's exactly what happened. And then the circumstances on Oladipo's situation were unique. And Sabonis ultimately was the guy that brings in Tyrese Halliburton. And you can go further down the line. Oladipo turned into Caris LeVert, who turned into Andrew Nembhard. So if you want to keep doing the transitive properties on that trade, you can get Paul George all the way down to Tyrese Halliburton and Nembhard and a couple of picks that came over in the Buddy Hield deal as well. So it's fascinating to look back at it that way. And when you look forward here, is all of a sudden, you know, the ease of the salary cap and having Tyrese Halliburton making, I think, single-digit millions and guys not being paid the max, all of a sudden that throws a significant challenge into things. But the front office from the Pacers' perspective has been talking about this type of move since they traded for Tyrese Halliburton. I think even they've been a little bit surprised at how quickly this has come together. But this has kind of all been in a grand plan. I think you just hope that it goes according to plan, and so far it has. And so how that looks in terms of getting to the apron and potentially into the luxury tax and all of that, I don't know what those answers are, but it does seem like they've been planning for this for a couple of years now.
Hey, Pat, last one for you here. Unfortunately, Jonesy and I haven't had a chance to get to Indy for a few seasons now. But from what I recall, and listen, check me and correct me if I'm wrong on this, for as amazing as the building is and the arena is, as outstanding as the fan base is and the passion for basketball, obviously collegiate ball, but pro ball as well, the history of the Pacers as well, there were times where I would look around and go, man, why isn't this building jammed and full? Like, even if the team's struggling, we're used to a team even in Toronto, even in the lean years, selling out damn near every single night. And maybe it's because of the passion for basketball where people won't accept anything but a legit team, a legit contender, etc. What has it been like, A, since Halliburton came, but certainly this season, now that there truly does seem to be this light that's coming and this momentum that's building and this team that's really coming together? And, you know, what is Indiana basketball like now, which I'm sure will only be highlighted and culminated by the All-Star festivities and everything else?
Yeah, and, you know, when you look back at the Victor Oladipo season, I think that was probably heading for a season where a lot of people thought that it was going to be a lean year, and he brought so much excitement, and the Pacers were contenders right away. And then you look at where they are now, and you go back to that middle couple of years, and COVID kind of thrown in the mix there too. And I think things just got a little bit stale. That group that we were referencing earlier with Brogdon and with LeVert and with Turner and Sabonis, I mean, that group had the potential, TJ Warren, and just never really got there. And I think things did get a little bit stale. And I know, you know, one thing our market struggles with that Toronto maybe does a little bit less is just the general size and the fact that, you know, in Chicago, for example, you have a city that size, you're going to find the number of people that fill out the building. But what's been interesting this year is almost, you know, from the opening jump, it's been a completely different environment. I think every single night has either been a sellout, or you're looking up into the corners and going, okay, I can spot, you know, a few open seats in the balcony here on a Tuesday versus Detroit. But this thing is pretty full and pretty packed. And yeah, the city and the state probably is predominantly college basketball. I mean, Indiana University here is that type of team that even when they're not good, you know, they're selling out their building and there's a rabid fan base, but there is a huge appetite for professional basketball here too. And it has been good to see the field house be as full and as packed and as rabid as it has been this year, because there were a couple of years where you would have looked at it and said, you definitely like to see that environment kind of come back. And so I think it's been really fulfilling to see that here lately and watch the town kind of gravitate around Tyrese Halliburton. From a Stars perspective, you know, there was Paul George, and then immediately he left, and then it was Victor Oladipo, and then immediately he got hurt across town with the Colts, the whole Andrew Luck deal. I think this city has been just dying for somebody to kind of sink their teeth into positively from a star perspective, and that appears to be what Halliburton is. And I think there's been kind of an instant love affair. It only took a couple of weeks to see this guy play and what he could potentially be. And then once he signed that extension, you know, I think most of the fan base here kind of said, okay, this is our guy. We're on board now. And it's been a pretty enjoyable season just from that perspective alone, the fan base, And yes, it has been a building that has been either full or very close to it all season.
Hey, Pat, we appreciate the time. Thanks for this, man.
Of course.
Thanks
for having me.
That was Pacers broadcaster, again, pre-half and post, sometimes doing play-by-play. He's all over the place on TV and radio in Indy, Pat Boylan. All right, we're going to step aside for a break. And when we come back, we will be joined by former NBA executive Bobby Marks. It's Smith and Jones. Welcome back to Smith and Jones. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. Thanks again to Pat Boylan for joining us off the top of the show. Again, folks, make sure you subscribe to Smith and Jones wherever you get your podcast. Download, subscribe, rate, review, and share. As we bring into the conversation right now, former NBA executive and general manager from ESPN, Bobby Marks.
Hey, Bobby, most of the dust has settled, and I say most because we had a couple of late buyout shenanigans with I saw the Patrick Beverley move coming a mile away, as did you. I remember you talking about it on another medium. But and then the Spencer Dinwiddie thing. So there's still some room for buyout people. Are there any more significant, impactful buyout people out there? And then that being said, what do you think was, give me your top three most impactful moves trade deadline as we turn the corner. I mean, everybody thinks of the All-Star break as halfway through the season. We only got 27 or 28 games left. We're two-thirds of the way through the season. So what are you looking at going forward?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We're writing the waiver slash, you know, buyout market here. I'm writing something for Monday to come out, and I'm having, like, writer's block because I'm, like, struggling with, yeah, I think we got a little bit spoiled last year, certainly with Russell Westbrook and Kevin Love, and we had Patrick Beverley again and Will Barton. You know, there were a bunch of guys that wound up getting, there were eight or nine guys that got bought out of their contracts, and there's only been a handful so far. You mentioned Kyle in Charlotte, he's going to sign in Philly. You know, you guys in Toronto waived Dinwiddie, and now he's with the Lakers here. I don't know if it's because of the markets, you know, not as deep with players. I think Marcus Morris could be a guy if he's waived or when he's waived by, you know, San Antonio. That will be an interesting name. But what the rules, you know, this collective bargaining agreement, it limits, you know, teams, these high-spending teams to go out and sign, you know, players like Lowry if you're over the, you know, over this apron here and if you make $12.4 million or more. I mean, there's a bunch of guys in Detroit that were waived, you know, certainly with, you know, Joe Harris, who, you know, really has not played well in the last couple of years and had some injuries. Danilo Gallinari is a name out there. I don't see Evan Fournier. And then you just kind of go like a little bit of a process of elimination at some of these teams that are kind of sitting in the bottom of the standings. Jetty Osman in San Antonio could be a good name here. So it is a little bit of a slower market. I don't know if it's because of the new CBA or just because there's not as many, you know, guys don't like doing buyouts these days. It feels like they feel like their next contract, they'll be labeled a minimum guy on their next contract here. And sometimes guys want to ride it out for the season, even if the opportunity to go for a play for a playoff team.
Bobby, I'll piggyback then. One of the second point, I guess, Jonesy was asking there is about maybe some of the impactful moves that actually were made on deadline day. And so aside from the buyout market, did any one stand out from deadline day, or is it more so maybe the moves, whether it be, you know, two of the big ones Toronto made that came before deadline day over the course of the season, even going back to the Harden move way earlier in the season as well?
Yeah. I know we got spoiled with the Harden trade and then, you know, Pascal and then OG and everybody wanted more. I was like, I don't think there's more out there. Like there was more trades and we hit a high number. I think there was 18 trades either on the day to deadline and leading up, you know, that Wednesday here. So there were high numbers, but everyone kept on saying it. There'll be trades, but it's going to be like, you know, your sixth man on your roster to your 10th man on your roster. And we certainly saw that there. I liked, and I know there's the draft ramifications that are going to come with it in Dallas. I like what the Mavericks did. You know, certainly I like the Daniel Gafford, you know, getting some insurance at center. Certainly with Derek Lively, their rookie, been in and out with some injuries. You know, PJ Washington, they also got from Charlotte. You know, the cost is steep. It cost them two first. And they did a pick swap in the summer when they got Grant Williams in the trade.
But I just feel like when if you've got, you know, as I said, Luka on your roster, you try to maximize as much as you can. Now, the challenge becomes with this Western Conference is so, you know, it's so deep. Dallas is fighting just to get into that top six here. So I liked what the Mavericks were able to do. I liked what, you know, Charlotte is interesting. You know, they're actually fun to watch. I mean, they've won three in a row. They've changed up the dynamic there. You know, you're not waiting on Gordon Hayward to come off the injured list, and LaMelo's still out, and they've got to figure out that piece. But the guys they got in the Oklahoma City trade, whether it be Trey Mann, for example, Seth Curry has given them a nice little a light lift there. Bertans gives Cliff some players, you know, NBA level players to play with here, and you know they're getting up and down the court here. And I like that Charlotte knew who they were, right? Like they knew they needed to maybe they're already in the lottery, but take a step back, pick up some draft picks, and kind of go in that direction.
Yeah, Bobby, I like the fact that the guys you mentioned in Charlotte they brought some winning. They've come from winning places, and they've brought some winning. I like that. And Eric and I have a soft spot, always do, for Coach Cliff. He's one of those kind of old school guys that has really morphed into the new age. But Bobby, you talk about the rules and the collective agreement, and I know that the second apron. And the aprons really limit the buyout. When you project ahead to the summer, is there anybody that you look at? Is there any team that you look at that you say, you kind of wave your finger at and you go, be careful, you're brushing up against that apron, against you're going to have cap issues. And just when you're starting to look like you might be a contender, all of a sudden there's no money to spend to bring people back.
I'm intrigued what happens in Minnesota. I really am. They're a team that gave out big contracts to Anthony Edwards and McDaniels in the offseason rookie extensions here. The Karl Anthony Towns Supermax kicks in year one. They're in a safe spot right now, but it's going to get awfully expensive. And they're one of these first or second apron teams here where it's going to be really, really restrictive as far as how to add outside of their own. And I think that's a big reason why they went out and got Monty Morris from Detroit. That was a trade they wouldn't have been allowed to do in the offseason here, as far as combine some salary to get a player, and they can re-sign him if they do. And certainly we'll keep an eye on Mike Conley over the next maybe month or two, as far as he's eligible to sign an extension here. But I think Minnesota is interesting just because they're sitting in the number one spot. And the team that's never gotten out of the first round with, certainly last year. And it was a good story last year. It was a good story the year before. But now the expectation is, you got to get to at least at a second round or a conference finals when you're a top seed. And if you don't, what's the ramifications as far as, from a spending standpoint? Do they take a step back here? So I would say Minnesota for me. But, man, you look at the league, though, there's probably a third of the teams, 9 to 10 teams that are dancing around this first and second apron here. As far as, you talk to teams, it's like you better like what you have on your roster, because adding outside, whether it be, in the free agent market or trade market, is going to be extremely tough.
Well, I don't know if that leads me to my next question or not, Bobby, but I'm going to ask it. We were talking earlier to Pat Boylan, one of the Pacers broadcasters, and kind of using the example of what Indy has been able to do. And listen, you've been there. I would think you can maybe acknowledge there's a whole hell of a lot of skill and talent that goes into putting together a team, but there's an element of luck as well. And what the Pacers have been able to do in a relatively short amount of time through – a couple of obviously key shrewd moves with Sabonis and Haliburton, and now with the acquisition of Siakam, not budging on, in spite of all the rumors and the chatter of otherwise, not budging on Miles Turner keeping around, and then hitting on draft picks, and whether it be Nembhard and certainly Mathurin and whatnot. You look at what the Pacers have been able to do in a relatively quick or short amount of time. Is this something that other teams, let's just say Bobby, the Toronto Raptors, could look to and say, yeah, we could do that. We could be that, because we've got young pieces still. We've got draft capital and draft picks and assets. We've got financial wiggle room. But now the key is we can't miss.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, we Tim Bontemps and I wrote about it a couple of weeks ago, and I asked that probably half a dozen executives kind of what's the perfect roster to build under this new collective bargaining agreement. And a lot of people, they did point to what Indiana has been able to do here with Halliburton about to start that rookie max, and then the likelihood that, they're going to get Siakam a big contract. But then when you look at it right after, there's a lot of players making $20 million or less. And you're right, you have to hit on Ben Mathurin and you have to hit on Andrew Nembhard. And I think Ben Shepherd, their rookie, is going to be a nice player here because you have that foundation here, because you're not going to be able to pay three guys $45 million. You can, but it's going to be awfully restrictive. And we talked about some of the rules here. And I think, I think if you're in Toronto and you're looking at it and you're saying, okay, Scotty's going to be our guy, he's extension eligible this offseason here. We have another spot for another guy, another number two, as far as, number two max guy, if we ever got to that point here. And then you look at it out there, with RJ and Quickly here and Pirtle, there's kind of a pecking order here. And you have to hit on your draft picks. It is so much of a priority with this new CBA, because you get these guys for 4 years on cheap contracts. And then you can kind of figure, and then it's like in a cycle, and it's almost like what Oklahoma City is going through here. And yes, eventually it's going to get expensive with Chet and Shea. Eventually is going to hit probably Supermax a couple of years from now, and Jalen Williams here. But the beauty of having draft picks is you can cycle through when Josh Giddey gets expensive and you got Cason Wallace there ready to replace him. And that's what I think the plan, certainly what you're starting to see in Toronto is that, we're going to have a likely lottery pick. If they keep it, you'll have a pick, from Indiana. You got Abaji in the deal, which is almost like a first rounder here. That's the goal here, is to have kind of inexpensive contracts here when, some of your guys get a little more expensive.
Bobby, Eric and I have said, people wanted the Raptors to pick a direction after starting this year with basically the same team the last 3 years. And you surprised people when you got back from Tampa. You were 500 last year. You're running it back again this year, basically with the same guys. And people were like, come on, can we pick a direction? Are we going to improve this? Are we going to tear it down? And it sure looks like there's a direction now, as you talked about and Eric mentioned, all the young guys. Does the timetable have to be expedited, as you said, because it's going to get expensive if they start playing well? Like, do you have to hit with draft picks and keep guys while they're inexpensive and add and move up quickly so you can attract other people? Because once you start paying all these guys, it's going to be tough to keep them. So we always say, Eric and I have been saying to the Raptor fans, okay, you got a direction, now pack your patience. But how much patience should they be packing, Bobby, with the way the salary structures are? And sometimes you might not be able to keep a guy. It might turn over quicker than you want.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to kind of what we talked about with Indiana. A couple of years ago, they picked the direction, but the direction they picked wasn't completely bottoming out, where they basically, you swap Sabonis for Halliburton. And I think when you look at what the Raptors did as far as with OG, and you get, Barrett and Quickly back, right? That's not bottoming out here. Siakam, you focus more on your draft capital here. I think there is a financial window before things get too expensive here. And I think it's probably, probably a two to three year window here. And I think what happens is that, and what you're going to see with the Pacers, the goalposts change, right? Like, you go from this fun loving, feel good team that sneaks up on people. Halliburton's a great story. And then all of a sudden you got, you're $20 million below the luxury tax, and you're limited with your draft capital here. So I think they're probably where Indiana was back in, I guess it was 2022, after the Halliburton trades, where there is that window there with financial flexibility. You moved off the Schroeder money, for that Dinwiddie expiring contract. Barnes' number will hit in 25, 26. That will be a big number. And then you start to, I'll be interested in what happens with Quickly here. So there is a flexibility, a financial window, probably in two years right now before things, do certainly start to creep up on you.
Bobby, we've talked about the Raptors here for a few minutes now, but I don't think we've really asked you straight up. Do you like what Toronto has done and what they have and the options they do have potentially in front of them? Like, what's your sense of Toronto?
I did. Yeah. No, I do. I like, as you guys said, they picked a direction. And, you know, there are teams, you know, you can say Atlanta and Chicago maybe should have followed suit here. Teams that are just kind of hanging out at nine and 10 here. And it's two different, as I said, two different ways they went about doing it. Like, I think the goal was, how do you stay relevant, but take a step back, which they certainly have done this year, but have the players to be competitive next year and then, you know, have a foundation moving forward where if you add another piece or another, or another player here, you can get back in the top six of the Eastern Conference, because it's not, you guys notice, I mean, you look at teams like Detroit and Charlotte that basically, I guess, bottom out. It's hard, extremely hard, because you're just relying on,
yep,
on, you know, lottery picks. I mean, it's a crapshoot here. And so I do like, yeah. I do like both trades. You move the late first round pick. Maybe you re-sign a Linick here, in the offseason here, but I do like that they were able to pick a direction. I don't think the rebuild is, you know, this isn't a 5-year rebuild. And I think the Eastern Conference allows you a little more grace compared to maybe if you're out in the Western Conference. If you're in the Western Conference, you're probably doing what Houston does, right? You try to draft, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait a minute. Like, you know, we're tired of winning 23, 24 games. We're going to go out and give Fred, you know, $140 million, and we're going to give Dylan Brooks $90 million. We're going to try to, you know, buy our way out of this in free agency.
Yeah, Bobby, I it's funny because Eric and I are like the parents waving our finger at the fan base who all want a tank. And you know this. Sometimes, I mean, there have been teams that have had draft picks for years.
I went through it in New Jersey, and it wasn't even a tank. It was just just had a god-awful team, and everything broke the wrong way. We were 12-70 in 09-10, okay? 12-70. One day I looked at the standings, and we were 3-40. Okay, and we went into the lottery with the number one pick. This was different before. The rules have changed a little bit here. We had the number one pick that year, and we wound up getting the third pick in the draft. Okay, so for people who want to tank, first of all, this is not the draft to do it. Now, if you're telling me that you can get Cooper Flagg next year, definitely, then I said maybe it'll be worth going through, but that is not even a given here. So tanking doesn't do anything. Talk to those teams that thought they had Victor wrapped up, you know, as far as this past year. I think there's got to be a position where you're putting your players in games that mean something. You know, maybe it's not this year, maybe, but it's going to be next year, where you're putting them in playoff type atmosphere here, whether it be like Oklahoma City did last year. And then you figure out, okay, who's our keepers and who do we need to move off of?
Bobby, that might be a perfect time to end it right there. I'm not sure what other direction to go, because you're going to send me down a path right there with Bronny James and when he's coming out and LeBron. And I don't even want to go there. So we're going to end it right there. We'll end the interview right with your word, not with my ramble here.
I spent a whole day yesterday talking about the I didn't think I'd be talking on February 14th about homes for LeBron James and, for 4 months from free agency. But we went down that rabbit hole yesterday, and hopefully we don't have to talk about that for a little while
We're gonna chop all this out here. We're just gonna end with your words.
as you know, man, sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction.
You got that right.
That was Bobby Marks from ESPN, former NBA executive and general manager, NBA front office insider for ESPN. We appreciate his time and his insight as always. And again, thanks to Pat Boylan for joining us on the show this week, as well as we are into NBA All-Star weekend and, well, week. We will be checking back again, though, next Thursday with fresh content on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and on your favorite podcast platform. So again, make sure you download, subscribe, rate, and review. Thanks to our producer, Austin Mackey. For Paul Jones, I'm Eric Smith. You've been listening to Smith and Jones.